The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network. Want to fearlessly explore your creative spirit? Join artist Susie K. Edwards for Path of the Butterfly, a weekend workshop at Omega Institute's beautiful campus in Rhinebeck, New York, May 24th through 26. Experiment with a variety of art forms, engage in mindfulness, walking, and silent meditation, and discover a new and free-flowing creative vision. This workshop is for beginners and professional artists. Learn more at eomega.org/thrive.
Hi, everybody. This is Rabbi Rami. Before we get to our guest, I want to update you on four changes we're making to our show as we enter our 10th year of podcasting. First, we're changing our name. The new name is Explore Spirituality with Rabbi Rami. Second, we're adding a listener Q&A feature using Mind Body Spirit FM app. You can find instructions on how to do that in our show description. Third, I'm starting a bi-weekly newsletter called Ask Rabbi Rami. To subscribe to the newsletter and register for my online and in-person classes and retreats, please visit OneRiverFoundation.org. One River Foundation is all one word, .org. Lastly, I've now taken on financial responsibility for this podcast, and I need help to keep it going. If you find value in the show, please visit OneRiverFoundation.org and donate. Now, on to the show. From the One River Foundation for the Study of Perennial Wisdom, I'm Rabbi Rami, and this is Explore Spirituality. Our guest today is my friend Kabir Helminski, who, along with his wife Camille, co-founded and co-directs the Threshold Society. The Society's aim is to provide an education in the universal principles of spiritual realization. Kabir is the author of many books, including Living Presence and The Knowing Heart, and his new book is The Mysterion, Rumi and the Secret of Becoming Fully Human. Kabir, Camille, and I have been friends and colleagues for decades. And Kabir, it is such a pleasure just to hear your voice and to have you on the show. So thank you for joining us on Explore Spirituality.
Thank you, Rami. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I am really honored. And the book is so fantastic. I'm going to tell you a story before we really get started on the book. Years ago, I was shopping in a grocery store in Napa Valley, California, and I got this call on my iPhone from a young woman. I don't know who she was, and she just called to thank me for my poetry. And she said she had this bracelet that she wore all the time and had a verse of mine that just spoke to her deeply every time she looked at it. Now, I have published a lot of poetry, but I'm not known as a poet. So I asked her to look really close at the, you know, after the verse had a little dash and then it gave the author's name. I said, just look at it really closely and spell the name out. And it was R-U-M-I. And I said, so I'm R-A-M-I. And before I could tell her who Rumi was, she apologized for bothering me and said she tried to find Rumi's cell number and give him a call, and she hung up.
I hope she found him.
Yeah, I hope she did. So here's my first question. Clearly, I'm going to assume she's sort of representative of a lot of people who love Rumi's poetry. I'm sure she didn't know much about Islam, and she didn't know really much of anything about Rumi or Sufism, and she was going to call him, but he is one of, if not the best-selling poet in the United States. What do you think the attraction is?
Well, poetry is the language of the soul, and in poetry, we can say one thing and mean another. We can use the images and stories and even jokes of our everyday life, and yet in a certain context they take on. So Rumi's genius, I would say, is that he's able to communicate sublime and subtle and profound spiritual truths and do it often with metaphors and images that a child could understand. At the same time, I mean, I think that might account for his popularity. I don't mean to write him off as someone who's an easy read, because if what Rumi expects us to understand, you could say it's unsurpassed. And yet by reading Rumi in you might say, the true sources in good translation, he educates us about the nature of reality, and he transforms our capacity for spiritual perception so that we're able to begin to see the spiritual reality in which we live. So I'll say a little bit more, because there's also some things that Rumi acknowledges very explicitly. And one is how our state of human brokenness can sometimes be an opening into a new relationship with reality, an opening of the heart, a deeper sense of the meaning and purpose of existence. So behind everything that Rumi is saying is a foundational, I won't say belief, perception that we live in a meaningful, purposeful reality, and that the purpose of this reality has something to do with cosmic love, all the way down to human love, and that there is an incredible generosity and beauty woven into the fabric of existence. So that is enough to touch hearts, I think. That's enough to blow minds and offer consolation on one hand, but much more than consolation, to offer us this kind of profound security amidst all of the grief and challenge and joys of life.
Let me ask you something about this distinction between perception and belief, which I think directly ties into your notion of security. And I want to ask you two things about it. One, if I just heard you right, you're saying Rumi had this perception, and not just belief, but a perception of this reality. And I want you to explain that to us. But then I think, and you can deny this if you want, I think you have the same perception. And I want to explore that with you in the context of how you came to Rumi, how you came to Sufism, to get a sense of your own spiritual journey. But let's start with this notion of perception versus belief in the context of Rumi.
People have all kinds of beliefs, and beliefs are not necessarily tied very closely to reality. It's nice when they are in harmony with reality, and when our beliefs are in harmony with what I would call spiritual laws, they may actually open up perception. But I think at the heart of this book, The Mysterion, is the understanding that the human being is designed or is created with a capacity to know reality increasingly in its fullness, that is something innate to us. And that's what is meant by this word, the mysterion, an unusual word, not even used before in the Sufi vocabulary, but in the Sufi vocabulary, the word it's translating is sir, which means secret, your inmost secret. So the inmost secret of the human being is something like a portal to divine reality, not a portal that leads us out of or away from material existence, but a portal that opens up within material existence and transforms how we see material existence, how we perceive nature, how we perceive each other. If we can perceive when we come into relationship with each other, if we're relating soul to soul rather than ego to ego or personality to personality, then this is what I mean by the perception of the spiritual nature of reality. It has to do with what I'll call a parallel dimension. On the one hand, we live in this material existence, which can be approached scientifically and measured and understand through mathematics, and science works in this realm. But that is only one dimension of our existence. And this, what I'm going to try and explain now, I think, is something really fundamental, that side by side with our sensory perception, which science utilizes and instrumentalizes as well in order to make, to conduct the work of science, in addition to that, there's a whole other dimension that not even quantum physics really touches. And that's the dimension of human consciousness / soul / heart. It's a dimension of our subjective experience. And when I say subjective, I don't mean, subjectively distorted, but subjective in the sense of what we deeply feel, and not only feel, but it's a dimension in which values lie. I don't think there are any values in the world of science. There are measurements and laws that may be described. Let's say that human consciousness, through this mysterion, through this portal to the qualitative dimension of reality, has a sense of value. And just to keep it really simple, why is it that we value relationship? Why did you reach out to me, Rami, and why am I so happy to be here with you? We long for relationship. We long to communicate in this human-to-human dimension. It's one of our values. Unless, if we're a reasonably healthy human being, we all seek relationship, not just human relationship and not just for our social entertainment. We crave intimacy. I mean, the beauty of sexuality is not the physical experience. It is an experience of intimacy. Now, the mystic takes this even further, because the mystic is the one who's fallen in love with God. And the mystic is the one who, but let's bring it all back to the simple model of two dimensions of reality. What's truly human is this capacity of the heart to perceive relationship, to perceive value, to perceive meaning, not just as an intellectual analysis, but meaning in the sense of what is meaningful in my experience, what really matters when I come to the moment of leaving this earth plane, what will really matter then? So two dimensions. One is the sensory, mathematical, scientific, and the other is the dimension of qualitative experience, which is perceivable by a faculty innate to the human being, which we call the heart. Shall I pause there?
because you're not speaking theoretically. You're not explaining this is what Sufism says or this is what Rumi says. You're speaking from your own experience, so which I can attest to. I mean, I've known you for a long time. I think what you're saying is palpable to people who know you. So my other question around the same idea was, how did you come to this? I mean, you weren't born a Sufi. What drew you to this, and what was a little bit of your experience?
I think there's something innate to the human beings, and certainly I don't think I'm unique in this, but there's a yearning many people have, unless we are so numbed out that we can't recognize this yearning. But there's a yearning for something. And I think my yearning carried me from a young age. I mean, my early teen years, I can remember reading Thomas Merton, for instance, when I was probably 13 years old. And I wonder what I understood of it then. I had a book called Seeds of Contemplation. And I know that I sort of liked that book, but I don't know that I understood it or what meaning I drew from it. But the journey led me to leave behind the belief systems of my childhood and early teen years to a state, a place beyond religion, I would say, in which I crossed the threshold into spiritual practice like meditation, particularly Buddhism. So I was seeing my path unfolding through spiritual practice, through a sense that there was something positive about meditation. And I remember for some years, my mantra was Om Mani Padme Hum. That's still a beautiful and meaningful mantra to me. But something also shifted when, after I don't know how many years, 10 or 15 years of searching within mystical traditions, I came to the sources of the Sufi tradition in living human beings. So it was meeting those people who were the, you might say, ripened fruit on the tree of Sufism. They were the mature human beings, the spiritually mature human beings, with whom I felt quality of unsentimental love, of a profound acceptance that allowed me to feel and experience, as I never had before, the experience of being loved, not by a person, although in a way it did come through an 80-something-year-old man, but it wasn't limited or exclusively focused on him. I would say it was in his presence and in relationship to my Murshid Sulamandede, my first real Sufi teacher, that I sort of felt drawn into this, what I could call love's universe, and where just being in the presence of Sulamandede, there were a lot of tears, unsentimental tears. There was no emotionalism in those circles, but there was a sort of overwhelming sense of gratitude, of being at home, of being accepted. And that was the spiritual gold after having perhaps experienced silver and brass and the other metals. But this was the spiritual gold. And
no, I was going to say, what you're talking about is something you write about in the Mysterion, your new book, when you sort of define Sufism, and this is the phrase you use, as the process of purification. And then you say this about it, which makes it so relevant to our, I mean, it's always relevant, but maybe specifically to this moment. This is, you write this, "This is why in Sufism, it is not recommended to start a campaign, put on a uniform, or raise a banner, but rather polish the mirror of your heart, be thankful in every circumstance, be aware with every breath." And that's right from the beginning of the book. And I mean, that seems to be what you're describing.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how is that message faring in a time when every religion, I mean, Sufism, I just assumed people knew, but Sufism is sort of the mystical side of Islam. So how is Sufism faring in a time like ours when every religion is captured by campaigns and uniforms and banner waving in a sort of militarized messianic fervor of us against them? Is your teaching, are people gravitating toward it, or is it falling on deaf ears more than it has been in the past?
It's touching the hearts of those who are ready to be touched.
Okay.
And there's no lack of such people. There's a lack of knowledge in our American and Western societies that the hunger, the demand for this substance, this energy, this knowledge is much greater than the supply. And so it's as if when people begin to hear things expressed in a certain way and not clothed this or that religion, although obviously I use the word Sufism, but I don't depend on that label. Or even in this conversation, I promise you could have this whole conversation without me referring to Islamic Sufism, but I'll confess that's where I'm coming from. But I believe the most important issues that we address, and I know you appreciate this, Rami, these are existential matters. These are things that are experienced in our own existential situation. And I'm happy to talk to an agnostic or an atheist or somebody of any religion and get to the point of what is your experience? What do you value? What do you hold sacred? And what are you doing about that? How are you cultivating that relationship with the sacred? How do we do that? And that can be expressed. If I had to express it in terms of religions other than my own, I could. It so happens that I work within a tradition, and I'm grateful for working within the tradition because it gives me a vocabulary, it gives me a vast resources to draw on, including the poetry of Rumi. But at the same time, we can talk about these things in a universal way, in a sort of matter-of-fact, experiential way, as I started out to do by describing these two dimensions of our experience. And how do we cultivate this dimension which is where we are living from our hearts? And that's not just a sort of sentimental proposition. It's not about becoming emotional. It's about, and there's actually a science behind it, you could say, or a spiritual psychology that lies behind this. And I give simple principles of that spiritual psychology. And one is that we have to be less dominated by thought. We need to quiet the mind and bring some stillness to our emotions, to sink to that level in ourselves, or to draw back into that part of ourselves, which is our essential self, which is able to, if only for moments, experience life and the reality in front of us without the veils of bias and egoism and, conditioned thought and propaganda, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a training that is essential to this. Although one might experience a sort of contact high from being in the presence of someone who has matured in this reality, because there's a vibrational resonance, there's a transmission that happens around such people. And that's a good taste, a good beginning, but ultimately there is a practice. And the practice has to do with what I like to call heartfulness, which is sort of mindfulness squared. It's mindfulness plus heartfulness plus the heart. In other words, it's the refinement of attention that simultaneously allows us to access directly the experience of our heart, which is our most profound instrument of knowing. It's where we know true relationship. It's where we know a sense of awe and wonder in certain moments. So there is a practice, there is a training, and it's a moral ethical training. It's also training of attention and will, and it is also leads inevitably, I think, to an increase in our capacity for love. Not because love has been made a moral imperative. You must love, God is love, you better love. No, because love is the very nature of being, that when we clear everything else away, that's finally what we're left with.
Want to fearlessly explore your creative spirit? Join artist Susie K. Edwards for Path of the Butterfly, a weekend workshop at Omega Institute's beautiful campus in Rhinebeck, New York, May 24th through 26. Experiment with a variety of art forms, engage in mindfulness, walking, and silent meditation, and discover a new and free-flowing creative vision. This workshop is for beginners and professional artists. Learn more at eomega.org/thrive.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, you talked about, you're working within a tradition, and you're grateful for that tradition, and the tradition comes with a vocabulary. And one of the things you write about in the Mysterion is you make note that the word lover is used to describe the seeker, which makes sense because the word beloved is one of the most common words to refer to Allah, to refer to God. And I'm wondering what you think the implication is of speaking of the seeker as lover and God as beloved, as opposed to talking about the seeker and God is Lord. You know, this seems to me, using lover, beloved, as opposed to seeker and Lord, those are two very different categories, two very different, the language has two very different sets of resonances. So what's your sense of that?
And thank you. What a great question, by the way. And I would use both languages, both modes. But let's talk about the lover, because, you know, in the spiritual universe, we have many archetypes, spiritual archetypes. You know, you have the shaman, you have the yogi, you have the hierophant, you have the ascetic, you have the recluse or monk. Rumi, which is the tradition that I'm at home in, talks most often about the lover. And he has says so many, you know, charming things about the lover. He talks about how even, you know, the lover is sometimes portrayed by Rumi as a kind of hapless, helpless, almost naive being. But he says that the mistakes of the lover, even the mistakes of the lover, are better than the righteous actions of the merely pious. So love is the final criteria, not that it is divorced from knowledge. Knowledge supports love. Without knowledge, we wouldn't truly know what's worthy of our love. That's where metaphysics comes in. And to carry that metaphysics a little bit further, I love the saying of a great Sufi, Ibn Arabi, who describes the whole process we're talking about in this way. He says, "My journey was entirely within myself. And when I came to the presence of my Lord, when I came to that, you know, absolute nearness, I saw," and I like to put that "I" in quotes, "I saw that I was nothing but servanthood without a trace of sovereignty." I was nothing but servanthood without a trace of sovereignty. So all agency, all sovereignty is with the Lord. And the word Lord here we translate as, it really means our educator, the one, you know, by the way, Rab is rabbi. It's this, I believe it's the same root. So Lord in the Quran is Rab, the Rab il Alamin, the Lord, the educator of the universes, all universes. So when I came to the presence of my Rab, I saw that it was all my Rab's doing that brought me there, that made it possible, that created the yearning in me and so forth. So these two things are not opposed. The falling in love is the action of cosmic love on the individual human soul drawing it home. And even though no one attains that nearness without effort, no one who hasn't made the effort attains that nearness, our spiritual work has a place. And yet the agency, the mystic would say, the Sufi mystic would say, and this is the non-dualism within Sufism, and Alist Iskot, as I think you say on your email, you know, that there is this mysterious oneness operating, that the yearning that the human being feels, and which is a particularly human quality, is engendered by the divine. But practically speaking, a direct way to that nearness is falling in love with God by, and first of all, perhaps by meeting human beings who embody that love. I don't think I would have much idea of what love of God was if I hadn't experienced it from and with and near to certain human beings around whom, with whom that love became more real for me. So I only learned to love God, and not love an abstract God, but love a very human, personal God, personal yet non-dual. That's the mystery there. You know, it's a non-dual reality on the one hand, since all agency is with the divine. At the same time, the little child kneeling at their bedside, praying naively to God, that's also true, absolutely true, because this thing we're calling God is not just some impersonal abstract reality, not some infinite white light, but something near to our hearts, something that has a kind of tenderness and majesty at the same time.
Yeah, if it's truly non-dual, then it includes the personal and the transpersonal. There's no
yes.
distinction. Yeah, you know, we're running out of time. I have one question left for you, but I have to say one other thing. One of the things I love about talking with you and others who, you know, have the mastery of Arabic, you know, you talked about, if I'm saying it right, Rab Alamin. No?
Yes. Goodness.
So, goodness, thanks. Yeah, I took Arabic. I flunked it along with a lot of other languages. So we have Rabbanu Shel Olam. It's the same phrase in Hebrew. So I've always, the standard translation is master of the universe, but it's the same root. It's Rav, Rabbi, Rab is in the Arabic. So, but it never occurred to me to translate it as educator of the universe or educator of all worlds. I mean, that's just that little difference, which doesn't change the Hebrew at all. It just gave me another dimension with which to look at it. I mean, that's so, that's the beauty of sort of interspiritual conversations, when we can look at these truths from different languages and discover, you know, even greater depth to each of them. So I really thank you for that. Let me ask you my last question, and then I will let you go. So I found the Mysterion, Rumi and the Secret of Becoming Human, to be a very, very hopeful book. And as the book comes to a close, you admit that we face tremendous obstacles to peace and human flourishing. But you write, I'm going to quote you here, you write, "There is no force stronger than spiritual realization, and there is reason to be hopeful that enough people," I want to come back to the phrase enough people, "there is reason to be hopeful that enough people will awaken from the narrowly egoic station and graduate to the level of true individuality, an individuality in resonance with a higher order reality, a connection to the sacred." So my question is, how many people is enough? So in Judaism, we actually have a number. So in Judaism, the number is 36. So you have to have, this is from the 4th century, it's a rabbi named Abaye. He said there have to be 36 human beings, he called it awake to Shekhinah, awake to the presence of the divine, to keep human civilization from collapsing under the weight of its own ignorance and arrogance and delusion. So I think he took it literally. I would take it metaphorically, but still, he had a number, 36. So do you have a number in mind, or, you know, what's giving you hope? How many, are we close to the number you're looking for, or what?
No, Rami, I couldn't give you a number, but what I am confident of, and the way I like to look at this situation, this horrific situation, we're all in a planetary dark night of the soul. I would like to view humanity as a whole with compassion and hopefulness, and always remember that the Rabbil Alamin, the educator of the universes, has the final say, and that the lie cannot survive, truth must prevail, and that humanity is going through an awakening process, and as grim as our situation seems, humanity is held within this loving reality and is learning by the contrasts we find in this world, and that the light has, light and truth have enormous power, and it's not something that is going to be achieved by numbers. Okay, it's not a quantitative matter, it's a qualitative matter. In that sense, I might be closer to agreeing with 36 than say 36%, but I think it's a lot more than 36.
Okay, I'm going to stick with 36. I'll count you. I'll count your wife Camille. So now we only have to find 34 more people.
But 36 anyway, it's 9, isn't it? 36 actually is 9.
Okay, that's so. Are you lowering the threshold?
No, but 9 is a number of completion.
Okay. Now we're getting. a little more esoteric than we have time for. But I'll give you the last word on that one. So at least we ended on a hopeful note. Our guest today, Kabir Helminski, is the director of the Threshold Society and author of the new book, The Mysterion, Rumi, and the Secret of Becoming Fully Human. You can learn more about his work at his website, sufism.org. Kabir, thanks so much for being with us on Explore Spirituality.
Thank you, Rami. So great to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Always great talking with you, too. Explore Spirituality with Rabbi Rami is a project of the One River Foundation. Our producer is Ezra Baker Truppiano, and our executive producer is Frank Levy. Our theme music is composed and played by Aaron Shapiro and Max Lichtman. If this episode has left you with more questions, you can share them with us through the free mindbodyspirit.fm app. Instructions on how to use the app can be found on our show's description page.
What is it you really want in life? No matter what you've been through, you can still achieve it. I'm Sandra Ann Taylor, and in my Energy Activation podcast, we'll explore the science of manifestation, and I'll give you specific techniques to shift your energy in order to make your dreams a reality. I also do live energy readings, and you can be a part of the show by emailing your questions to me at sandrataylor.net. Join me on the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network or wherever you get your podcasts.